Welcome to the Lancet Respiratory Medicine Podcast. I'm Rebecca Craven, and we're very pleased that Daniel Altman, Professor of Immunology at Imperial College London, has agreed to join us to talk about immunity following SARS-CoV-2 natural infection and vaccination. We recently published a personal view by Gregory Milne and colleagues that addressed the question of whether infection with or vaccination against SARS-CoV-2 leads to lasting immunity. In a comment to accompany the paper, Daniel Altman and Rosemary Boyton consider what waning immunity to SARS-CoV-2 means for vaccine booster strategies. First, could you explain in simple terms what we've learned so far about the humoral and cell-mediated immune response to SARS-CoV-2 infection?
The brief answer is an absolutely immense amount with a very, very steep learning curve. Bear in mind, this is a virus that's new to humans, where we got the first sequencing through on January the 10th, 2020. And we probably know more about the human immunology of this virus now than almost any other virus we've ever studied, certainly huge data sets. So the simple first fact that everybody knows and everybody needs to know is that the point of contact, the point of entry for the virus into the cell, is the binding between its spike protein and the ACE2 receptor on the human cell surface. And if you could make good levels of neutralizing antibodies that could neutralize spike in that interaction, then you could prevent people getting infected. And that was the first thing we ever knew, the first thing we ever extrapolated from knowledge of SARS and MERS. And it's true, and it's the most important piece of immunology you could know, and the basis for almost all of our vaccines. You need really good neutralizing antibodies against spike. If we carry on from there, obviously you can make it much, much more complicated. As people know, the immune system is a really complicated beast with thousands of different cell types that we get excited about. The B cells that make the antibodies, the T cells that kill infected cells and help to make the antibodies. And sure, there's an enormous repertoire of B cells and T cells and other cells that are targeted on SARS-CoV-2, and they're all certainly playing their part, and there are really fancy experiments to look at the contribution of different cell types. But in some ways, they're dwarfed compared to the contribution of the key correlate of protection, which is making a really super high neutralizing antibody response to spike so that it can't get into your cells.
What do we know about the durability of protective immunity after natural infection and the risk of reinfection? And how does this durability vary according to factors such as age and initial severity of disease?
We came into this with some knowledge, but have learnt a lot very fast. So the knowledge we came into this with was just general knowledge of coronavirus immunity, things like the common cold coronaviruses. And that was kind of discouraging, yes, because if there's one thing everybody knows about the common cold, it's that we get them every damn winter, year after year in perpetuity. So why didn't your immunity from last winter protect you for this winter? And that's to do with evolutionary strategies that coronaviruses have to subvert immunity and make the immune memory less potent. So that was our expectation for SARS-CoV-2. And it's kind of been borne out. So what do I mean by that? I mean that if you look at people's immune responses after a live infection, they have terribly variable levels of immunity afterwards, like you'd expect for any spread of humanity, any human phenotype. Obviously, those at the bottom end of that distribution are more vulnerable to reinfection than those at the top end. And if you try and calculate the decay kinetics of how long immunity lasts, you'd put a figure on it of, depending on where you are on that curve, of course, but at best, certainly less than a year before you might be vulnerable. And in all studies of infected, unvaccinated people, we see a reinfection rate of perhaps 4 or 5%. Sometimes can be serious. We had one person in one of our studies who died second time around, more so with older age. The quality or quantity of your immunity, though, isn't necessarily directly correlated with how severe your infection was.
A number of different types of vaccines have been approved for use in different countries. What do we know about the features and durability of the immune response to vaccination?
If immunity after live infection, as we'd kind of predicted, is somewhat ephemeral, what can we say about immunity after vaccination? So I think most people have got on board the idea that nearly all the vaccines we're talking about here, the mRNA vaccines, things like Pfizer and Moderna, the adenovirus vaccines, things like AstraZeneca and Sputnik and J&J, are really pretty good vaccines, better than many of us were expecting to produce in that timescale, inducing really high levels of immunity, really high levels of protective efficacy. And if you'd asked me at the start of all this, I'd have said, well, they won't be perturbed by the same problems that live infection had. Vaccines are designed to give you long-lasting immunity. And I guess that's what they'll do. It'll be more long-lasting. The way it's played out, I think, two things have happened, haven't they? One is that we hadn't had a chance to learn that much about durability of immunity following things like mRNA vaccines, because we'd never looked at them over that timescale before. And then, of course, the big confounder came along in terms of a much more pernicious variant in the form of Delta. And the evidence was there to see, first of all, in the very large Israeli cohort study, that particularly if you were over 60 and if you'd received your second Pfizer vaccine dose more than 6 months previously, your levels of protective immunity were dropping to precarious levels, such that Delta breakthrough infections were starting to be very, very frequently seen. So we've started to do, around the world, lots of studies on durability of post-vaccine immunity. And considering the rather high levels of neutralization we need for protection against things like Delta, it looks like most people are probably needing a boost at about 6 months to be safe.
Are there concerns about vaccine effectiveness against new variants of SARS-CoV-2?
As the pandemic roared on and we had more and more millions of cases across planet Earth, millions of cases means millions of lungs in which billions of copies of virions are replicating. And although SARS-CoV-2 doesn't have a particularly high mutation rate for a virus, at that scale on the planet, that's sufficiently high to generate a lot of mutations, and out of a lot of mutations, you can occasionally get a number of phenotypically advantageous mutations for the virus that become variants of concern because they can bind human cells and transmit better, or can spread between human cells better, or can evade antibodies or T cells better. And that's what we saw through the whole of 2021 around the world in terms of alpha and beta and gamma and delta. And with each new variant of concern, the race amongst researchers has been on to map how big a difference this makes to effectiveness of protective immunity. And for most of the time, I think most of us thought the answers weren't that scary. So you could suffer a loss of perhaps 5 or 10-fold neutralizing ability if you were trying to neutralize alpha or beta or gamma variant of concern. But considering that most people vaccinated had such terrific levels of immunity, that didn't seem to matter. But then two new things happened. One was Delta, which, eroded that protective headroom more than the others. And the other was that coinciding with our somewhat unpredicted rapid vaccine immunity waning. And that's been the explanation for the Delta breakthrough peak that so troubled us and has needed the booster campaign.
And what does our current knowledge of the protection offered by infection with or vaccination against SARS-CoV-2 mean for vaccination programs or other strategies to reduce the risk of infection?
So I feel like maybe at this stage in the pandemic, when, the story has changed so rapidly, hasn't it, in terms of what we know about the vaccines and what we know about the virus and what we know about variants of concern, that some people out there, I sense, are getting quite irritated by scientists who keep on changing the story. But we keep on changing the story because the story keeps on changing. But the bottom line remains true, yeah, that obviously, this is a horrific virus that has had devastating consequences for planet Earth. And we, by which I mean the world medical research community, was able to come up with some really stupendous vaccines really quite fast. And they have been the answer, and they are the answer, and they've mitigated the pandemic to a very large degree compared to the number of deaths that we would have been facing now, and the absolute pandemonium that we would have been facing now if we continued with this, the kind of numbers we saw in the early first and second waves. And I think we're at a stage now where the game has changed. We've realized we need boosters. We've realized we need to be able to grapple with variants of concern, especially Delta. But I think it's quite a calm, tangible battle strategy, if you like, that's working out and winning through.
What challenges do we face on a global scale in building and maintaining protective immunity against SARS-CoV-2 and reducing the burden of COVID-19?
Of course, people are aware, one hears expressions like none safe till we're all safe. And I really, really want to stress that this isn't some kind of, wishy-washy liberal altruistic platitude. This is clinical medicine, yeah? So the wealthier Western nations in the EU and the USA have bought up several billion doses of vaccine in reserve, enough to vaccinate every human being in Europe and the USA from birth to death 4 or 5 times over, which is far more than we need. On the other hand, a vast proportion of planet Earth have received no vaccines yet. And so when I talk about that, this isn't just about fair play and decency, though obviously one could talk about that. It's about stating the obvious, isn't it, to say that if we're trying to come out to the other side of the pandemic and not live like we've lived for the last nearly 2 years now, forever and ever, it makes no sense to have virus continuing to percolate around the globe in millions and millions and tens of millions of lungs, generating new variants of concern. Because as we all saw in December 2019 to January 2020, you can think you've got it under control or got border restrictions or whatever it is, but this is a virus that can sneak around the world in the blink of an eye, and then you're back where you started. And so if we don't want to be having these discussions for years and years about ever more variants of concern that we failed to control, which have arisen because we were too selfish to vaccinate people who weren't in our country, we really do need to address this and look to the initiatives both to be sharing vaccines more equitably, but also producing vaccines more broadly.
Are there particular areas of research that you would identify as a priority?
I think we've moved on in leaps and bounds since January 2020 and learnt so much at quite a high level of granularity. There's so much more to do. We need to generate better and better vaccines as we learn more about the immunology and more about protective mechanisms, not just the key point about neutralization of spike, but other ways of stimulating responses to other parts of the virus. Bear in mind, this is a virus that has quite a large genome and produces 29 proteins, all of which are to a varying degree targets for immune attack. So we need to slow down and look at those things in more detail. If we're going to face a period when we're talking all the time about vaccination and waning and durability and immune monitoring and immune certification linked to jobs, that suggests that we've got to do far, far better than we're doing at the moment on immune monitoring and understanding who out there has what kind of levels of immunity, so that any certification or any public health guarantees actually carry some kind of meaningful value. And then another biggie, I think, in terms of understanding the immunology of this infection is that one of the consequences of any infection by SARS-CoV-2 is long COVID, which leaves a very bitter legacy so far for many people for nearly 2 years of disability and loss of quality of life. And an enormous challenge is to sort out the underlying immunology of that. How does a virus do that to you? And if we can sort out how it does it, we can both diagnose the cases properly and hopefully treat people properly and get some of their quality of life back. So plenty still to do.
Thanks very much for joining us.